Who else is joining us? Oh, that's right. They're on mute. We have a really large number of people who signed up for this call, over 200. So at least for now, everybody is being kept on mute while Deanna presents. And then we've got a lot of questions, and we may open it up at some point for people to ask questions, other additional questions. But we are thrilled that you've joined us.
Shall we begin?
Please.
Hi, everybody. I'm Deanna Nagel from the Online Therapy Institute, Online Coach Institute, and today we are going to talk about online coaching. So I think what Ellen did with the registration is she sent out the ability for you to ask questions of me. And again, with 200 people, you can imagine we have quite a stack of questions. So what you can expect to get today is a broad brush, but we will certainly be making sure that you get the information you need, or at least the resources that will get you to the answers that you need. So Ellen will be sending out a follow-up email afterwards. So I wanted to start out with discussing the ethical framework for the use of technology in coaching. I think some of you may have received that already, and hopefully you've had a chance to review it. And ethics can be a yawner sometimes, so I don't want to really turn this into lecture mode, but I just wanted to hit some of the key points of the ethical framework. And this framework was written a couple of years ago in conjunction with the Institute for Life Coach Training, because we felt like coaches needed some guidance with the use of technology, particularly around issues like confidentiality and the use of social media. So we wrote it, and it was published in our magazine, Tilt Magazine, Therapeutic Innovations in Light of Technology. And it has since been sent to many organizations. And when we form an ethical framework at the Online Therapy Institute, our goal is to offer a framework for other organizations and professional affiliations to have a reference point for starting when they want to add information about technology. So with that, I'll just go over some of the highlights. Coaches have a sufficient understanding of technology, and what that means is that coaches don't need to be IT professionals, but they certainly need to understand the basics, like what encryption is and how to find encrypted programs, understand what backup systems they have on their computer, understand what password protection is and why that's important, have firewalls on your computer, either external or internal, virus protection so that you're protecting your information as well as your potential clients' information from computer viruses, different from, of course, we want to also be protected from colds and flu, but that's a different topic altogether. Hardware, understanding the hardware and software that's in your computer, and then understanding the importance of knowing who your third-party services are. So it's not necessarily just okay to choose a company on the Internet and use them, for instance, for your email or your video conferencing platform without doing some due diligence about knowing who they are and what their references are like and if they get good reviews. And, of course, coaches work within their scope of practice, and that varies depending on what schooling you may have achieved, where you're located, what your specialty is, what your niche is, and also whether you are also a licensed mental health professional. And for those of you in the United States, we know that mental health counseling is regulated. It's a regulated profession, but coaching is not. So there are some issues there with knowing what exactly your scope of practice is when you have more than one hat that you wear. Coaches seek out training, knowledge, and supervision. Said differently, coaches hopefully are not working in a vacuum. So we really encourage coaches to seek out information through professional development, through workshops and phone calls and information gathering like this call you're on today, reading the current literature and hopefully engaging in either professional supervision and or peer supervision with some of your colleagues. Coaches display pertinent and necessary information on the websites, and I believe that was actually one of the questions. So having information on your website that allows potential clients who are coming to your website the ability to navigate easily is important. Having a clear website that's easy to navigate is paramount. Having crisis information, crisis intervention information on your website, which may seem odd when we're talking about coaching, but depending on the keywords that you use to build traffic to your site, people can land on your site from anywhere with various levels of distress. So if you, for instance, are a motivational speaker, they may actually have been looking for something that would motivate them out of a state of depression, for example. So just having on your website, on even on the bottom of the page, something that says, if you are in crisis, click here, or offer a phone number or additional web resources can be helpful. Having contact information other than just an email so that people know that you actually exist and you have a postal address. And why would we need a postal address? Well, you know, when I go to Best Buy and I make a purchase, if I am not pleased with my purchase, I can either go back to the store or now I can email or even tweet them, but I can also write a letter of complaint or concern. So clients need to be able to contact you for accolades and for concerns that they may have. So having a real postal address is very important. Coach education, listing your various degrees or coach training that you have, certifications, professional development courses that you've been in, that can be very helpful. Terms of use and privacy policy, being clear on your website, particularly if you have opt-in email lists or you have some sort of login process for other membership opportunities, that you make it clear what your terms of use and privacy policy are. And in addition, if you are a practicing coach and in private practice, to offer a copy of your informed consent so that potential clients can read that in advance and know a little bit more about how you work. Informed consent would include a clear description of the coaching that you would provide the client. It would talk about how you would be accessing services and how the client would be accessing services. If you're using technology, what kind of technology are you using? Would it be email? Would it be Skype? Would it be some other video conferencing program? And then giving the limitations to that service if necessary and talking about how you protect the confidentiality for the client. You also need to talk about things like how you would proceed in a technology breakdown, because when we use technology, glitches will occur. So knowing that in advance and preparing you and your client for that inevitability can go a long way in keeping the client present and safe with you as in the coaching relationship. So having some sort of ground rule in place beforehand is important. Who to contact in case of an emergency, even though you're not necessarily working with your client in an emergency situation and you don't anticipate it, having that information ready for the client beforehand is important. Talking about how cultural specifics may impact treatment. And with cultural specifics, it's not just different ethnic backgrounds or different parts of the country that we may live, but it's also the culture of cyberspace. So having an understanding of your client's, how your client experiences cyberspace and knowing that in advance can be helpful, and also accommodating the client when necessary if they are heavily involved in cyberspace, and I could talk for another few hours on that, but just having some broad brush overview of what cyberspace is and all that it entails, not just email and not just Skyping with family, but that some people are very involved in virtual worlds and very involved in social media and take Facebook to another level, not just professionally or with family and friends, but it is part of their identity. And understanding that about your clients is important. Coaches conduct an initial interview and evaluate the client's ability to effectively engage in technology-enabled coaching. Simply put, making sure that your client's technology skills match up with the process that you will be using. And very simply, for instance, if you're using a coaching program or a self-coaching program that requires a login and more than just the average amount of tech savvy that most of us have by now, then you would need to screen your client for their ability and or teach them how to use your technology platform. And then coaches enter into a contractual agreement with the client to provide coaching services, meaning that when you have agreed to take on a client, that is within a contractual agreement and it becomes a contracted relationship, which your informed consent is part of that process. So that is a very, very brief overview of the ethical framework. Again, we'll make that available to you if you don't already have it. So, Ellen, do we want to dig into some of those questions?
Absolutely, and there are quite a few about informed consent.
Okay.
What elements would you include in your informed consent form for online coaching or counseling? And another going on, can coaching over email, Skype, etc. be okay if the client knows it may not be secure, but signs a form of consent?
Okay. What elements are included in informed consent? Well, issues like I just discussed, like having some information about who to reach out to if they are in crisis, even though that's not anticipated. My informed consent talks a little bit about how I do the work. And because I'm also a mental health counselor, I differentiate my roles within my informed consent. And I make it clear in the informed consent which hat I'm wearing with that client. I talk about the limits and the benefits of using technology, the technology glitches, what to do if you're disconnected. I talk about issues like, of course, pretty standard canceling an appointment, reestablishing an appointment. And I talk about confidentiality and how I maintain records. And I also talk about how I interact via social media with my clients. And because I'm a mental health therapist, I'm probably more conservative than somebody who does not also have a license, but I do not communicate with my clients via social media. So that would be some of the components of an informed consent.
Well, that leads to what are the uses and limitations of Facebook professionally, and is it a good idea?
I use Facebook professionally all the time. I have a personal Facebook account that my friends and family get bored with because I'm usually posting professional posts, and those posts are public. But I have a lot of information that I post on Facebook that is for family and friends, and that's private. So the public can't see my private setting, my private information, because it's only I have it grouped for different people. But we also have a business page, Facebook page, for Online Therapy Institute and for Tilt Magazine. And that is just, in my opinion, it's another web presence, just like your website. The difference is that people can also interact. So if you're a coach in private practice, and let's say you specialize in wellness coaching, then a Facebook page could be beneficial because you would be posting information for anybody that might be interested about around wellness issues. Where it gets sticky is when people start posting back wanting some sort of help or intervention from your Facebook page. So you just have to be clear about your own personal boundaries around that, and to be careful not to engage in any sort of coaching dialogue on that social media site, and that goes for Twitter and LinkedIn and all of the rest of them. Ellen, there was a question before that about email, or it was with the informed consent. I can't remember.
There are a number of them. There are also quite a few, Dana, on the dangers of Skype. Have you Skyped with individuals or group coaching? Is it legal or ethical to use Skype or teleconferencing in coaching? What are some of the techniques to ensure confidentiality of client communications over Skype? And is Skype HIPAA compliant? I know, it's your favorite topic.
Okay, just say no to Skype, and here's why. Skype is not HIPAA compliant. For coaches who are not therapists, coaches don't have to be HIPAA compliant. HIPAA is about billing insurance. But much as I really don't enjoy HIPAA topics, HIPAA has done us somewhat of a favor across the board, because if we use HIPAA compliant platforms, we have a better chance of protecting our clients' information the way we should be protecting it. The reason Skype is not HIPAA compliant is because, and I believe this was also a question somewhere on that list, is because Skype, first of all, is not in the business of healthcare, and that's what HIPAA is about. But Skype is not willing to enter into a third-party business associate agreement with a therapist or an organization like a hospital. And a HIPAA business third-party agreement states that basically that Skype understands confidentiality and how to keep those records secure, and everybody that works for Skype understands that as well. So it's sort of like if you use Skype, if you're just using video, it's encrypted, it's not recorded, but everything else is recorded and maintained on the Skype's servers. So that means anybody that works for Skype in the IT department has access to that information, and they might not have a need to know. So it's better to use video conferencing, audio conferencing, and text, you know, email and chat programs that are encrypted through HIPAA standard, because then we have a higher level of protection. The other issue with Skype is Skype is one of the number one programs that we download onto our computer that spread malware. So even if we didn't have the HIPAA issue, there's the issue of having malware on your computer and